Okay, we rolling. Cigarettes, rolling rollers on walls. And what else are we doing? Rolling mop buckets around dodgy kitchens in cocaine houses. I'm watching this big cockroach tuning in on Jay's food box when suddenly a gang of aggressive looking men rushed into the room.
Hey, you see Nella?
The ringleader asked. I think she might be at work, Jay replied in his polar opposite demeanour. He licked the paper of his joint and lit it off the stove as the aggressive gang left. Jay was sharing a bedroom with three other people in order to afford living here. He was reading a lot of library books, smoking a bit of weed, and working to get enough money to leave again. When he first arrived in Bondi, he got a job selling ice creams. The owner gave him a full tray of ice creams and a $150 float and sent him on his way. Off you go, young lad. Make us some money. Jay sold a few ice creams, but it was a cloudy day and business was slow. He decided to go home. When he passed kids in the street, he gave them free ice creams. The rest went to his flatmates and he spent the float money. It's a daft move because Jay is such a distinctive looking bloke, like 6'5", long curly hair and distinctive features. And it's too easy to identify. He got arrested and taken to the police station. They found weed in his pocket, and when they looked up his name on the computer, a string of fines appeared for failing to wear a cycle helmet when he was a cycle courier in the city. That bloody cycle helmet rule in Australia. Come back to bite him. The fines for the helmets, along with the stealing the ice cream money and the weed, he ended up with a $1,500 fine. But Jay couldn't afford to pay the fine. Because Jay, I was chatting to him on the phone the other day, and he'd always go down to the bare bones, like, oh, Rich, sorry, I'm down to my last 20 bucks. And I'm like, dude, why don't you save 1,000 and start worrying when you get to 1,000 like I do? And he'd always pay you back, but we'd always end up having to sort him out. One time he'd come back to me, he's like, oh, Rich, a few years later, I was pretty much settled in Sydney and he was staying at my place. He's like, oh, I don't want to be a dish pig and stuff anymore, but I've got this great idea because buy and sell stuff like cars. And he rang me from the auction, said, there's a couple of BMW motorbikes, cop bikes, and they're only $5,000 each. I've looked up on Auto Trader and they're worth about $12,000 each. But they were ex-police bikes. And I had the cash saved, so I said, oh, look, buy them, you know, and we'll split, share the profits, like. But he couldn't sell them, because at the end of the day, they were a BMW 750 motorbike, but they were police bikes, so they had all the kit for the police, not for, like, a dual saddle. And then he goes, oh, sorry, Rich, I got to go now. And he left. He left for England. I had these two cop bikes, and I was trying to sell them. I didn't even have a license, but I had to keep riding them around in the dark around Manly to keep the engines running, so when someone came to look at them, I could kick it up. And I nearly fell off a few times, and cars in front would always slow down because they'd see this cop bike behind them. That was some of the stuff that I ended up getting involved with Jay. But this time, he's got all these fines. And it was crazy. He didn't even have a work visa. And he ended up working, doing community service in a mental hospital so he could pay off this fine. And it didn't faze him. He's like, oh, don't worry, I'm still going to go to Indonesia. And sure enough, he paid off the money and saved enough cash. And in 5 weeks, he took off to Indo. So it just shows, you know, if you're determined, despite what's happening to you, you can still get out there and do it. So, well done, Jay. And what were you thinking with those ice creams, mate? The police were sympathetic to Jay's predicament, they put him on community service. He was to do 150 hours domestic duties in a low security mental hospital. Jay didn't even have a work visa for Australia, and he was doing community service. Classic Jay. One of my first jobs in the house was to rip up the stair carpet. I decided to start at the top and was pulling tacks outside Jim's room when he opened his door. Jim was a civil servant. Following a short introduction, he ripped the meat pie he had clutched in his hand in two and offered me half. Not wanting to seem ungrateful, I ate it. Jim moved out a few weeks later. He handed over his keys and I went in to clean out his room. Although Jim dressed respectably and guised his addiction to alcohol sufficiently, he lived like an animal. He was worse than Billy. Whatever I picked up or moved was infested with cockroaches. The dead ones with legs to the sky and the live ones quickly evacuating the room via a pipe box in that led to the bedsits below. There were literally hundreds and hundreds of roaches. The refrigerator was rife with them. With their antenna moving and shells clicking, they were attracted to the heat of the motor. When they died, the heat slowly cooked them and the odour was repulsive. It's like one of those really big old, rounded old fridge freezers with the big handles. The death traps that used to lock people in. They'd get locked inside and they'd die. The freezer was a solid block of ice. I thawed it out and found a slab of green bacon at its core. Like Billy's room, the walls were thick with lard, with the regular frying of meat. When I thought of the pie clutched in Jim's hand, I could see 100 wriggling cockroaches. I was close to retching. I actually, in Jim's room, I moved this table, and on the floor amongst the dust and cobwebs and nail clippings, I found an unopened letter addressed to Jim. And bearing in mind this was 1997, I think, at this stage. And it was 1996, and the letter addressed to Jim was dated 1984, and it wasn't opened, which meant he hadn't cleaned his room out since the letter fell down the back 12 years ago. Holy shit. Funny as well, when we ripped up the carpet in Jim's room, there was newspapers underneath to stop the carpet sticking to the floorboards, you know, the old trick. And there was all these, like, bodyboarders in the 1960s. They'd just invented the bodyboard, and those guys with short back and sides raving on about how great these bodyboards were. Classic memories. So this big fridge in Jim's room, it was really heavy, and we didn't have any trolleys or anything like that. So we had this great idea that we'd just launch it out of the window. They've got gas in them too, so I don't know if it could actually blow up. But I think Just was out the back going, yeah, yeah, sweet, sweet. Right, no one's coming. I just pushed this fridge out the window. Fucking kaboom! John come from the downstairs basement. What the fuck's going on? What the fuck are you fucking idiot? And then Tom came down, the fridge repairman, the guy on methadone. He's like, oh, dudes, don't damage the fridges. Don't damage the fridges. Please, I can sell them. Don't damage the fridges. That's when we actually found out it was a fridge repairman. And we gave him all the other fridges after that. My life at this point was very basic. I was at the bottom rung, but I never did without. I bought my groceries at the cheap Paddy's markets and ate fresh fish, vegetables and fruit every day. I ran along the beaches and swam the bays to stay fit. I lived as clean as I could, hand washing my clothes, mopping my floor, and my skylight was clean enough to warrant curtains. However, I let the sun in, and when the rays reached down to the bare floorboards, it was time to get up and do some work. I still didn't have a watch after the Indian Ocean incident. Sometimes I'd be too tired to move, and occasionally there would be a bang on my door, And through the spire, I'd spot Robert pacing the hall. Oh, shit. Sometimes I'd throw a dust. Occasionally, you'd just throw a dust in the air and grab a piece of sandpaper and just pretend you were working. There was asbestos found in the bathroom. Robert paid an extortionate price for a gang of Lebanese guys to come and bag it. The bathroom was stripped, and now the only water ran out of a tap in the backyard. I rigged up a hose to an old showerhead and got naked in the backyard, hiding from the passers-by behind an old sheet draped over a piece of copper pipe. Wrapped in a sarong, I stepped the flights back to my room, which was, as I said before, I think it's like, what, it's five stories, so it's right at the top. One day, Billy followed my wet footprints. "So this is where you doss down," he said, inviting himself in. "Listen, I was going to cook up some bangers and mash. I wonder if you fancied some." It was a kind gesture, but the thought of sitting in Billy's festering pit eating greasy sausages and watching pornos painted a terrible picture in my mind. Billy scanned my room. "Jeez, where's your fucking furniture? Where's your bed? Do you sleep on the bare fucking floorboards? Fuck, you haven't even got a TV. Sure, I was going to lend you a few pornos." "Mate, it's not much, but it's clean and the cobwebs don't tickle my nose when I'm in bed like down at your gaff." "Oh, fair enough," he said. And I think that's it. When you're travelling, you realise, when you've got to carry everything you own, you realise that possessions are a burden. And it's so relevant. So me living like so minimalistically just was a shock to Billy. But back then, it just meant that I had no outlays on my material possessions. There was one time, actually, a guy gave me a tent and I tested the weight of it and said, "Oh, sorry, bro, it's too heavy." Gave it back. I think if you carry all your possessions around for one day, you'd soon get jettison a few. It just goes to show that, like, people say, "Oh yeah, Australia, so lucky, you know, if you live there, you're just going to be happy." But there's all these people living in this bedsit, and they're all living these really horrible lives, locked in the little boxes. And there's me with hardly any money, making the most of it, eating really well and getting out to the beaches and staying fit and feeling alive. And that's a good reminder to myself, actually, that, like, what was I doing? I was exercising, I was riding a bike to the beach, I was running, I was swimming, I was eating good food. Whereas when money comes, yeah, it brings a few more comforts, but then it brings all the other shit, doesn't it? Like the chocolates, porno mags, fried sausages, all that shit, that they'd use their money for other things. So kind of makes me realize now that we get enough money, it's just that we spend a lot of it on stuff that's not that good for us. "Fair enough," said Billy. "I do live like a pig." It was summertime with long sunny days. In between jobs, I'd surf and chase the sun around Bondi Beach, trying to find a warm place to close my eyes before I had to go into work. Dish pigging in the cafe across the road, Liberty Lunch. Mad story there too, that years later I was chatting to my brother-in-law and we're talking about various stuff, and I started talking about this cafe, Liberty Lunch, and turns out through with all the millions of people in Sydney, me and him had washed dishes at the same sink. We'd both been dish pigs at this Liberty Lunch. It's just random. And we both had these crazy stories about what was going on there. The clock tower read 6 o'clock. I was late. I took a quick shower and raced across the road. I wandered through the cafe with my push bike on my shoulder, taking varnish off a chair leg with my pedal. The barmaid acknowledged my existence. I put on my apron, grabbed the spray gun, and blasted the remains of a risotto out of a frying pan. "Rich, honey, could you get some knives and forks out the front, please?" One of the waitress asks, she was cheerful and sassy, dressed in a uniform of black, short and tight to attract customers. The next time she came in, she wasn't so alive and confident. She seemed deflated and humble. She sniffled. I thought maybe she had a cold. Upstairs on my way to the storeroom, I disturbed the manager and one of the new fresh-faced waitresses. There was white powdery stuff on the table, and then it was stuffed into a drawer. The waitress was blinking her eyes. She was sniffing too. Now, that time, I didn't really know much about cocaine. I knew Eric Clapton had written a song about it, and Sting had said that cocaine was God's way of telling you that you had too much money. The line for the waitress was a freebie, a sort of initiation and allegiance to turn a blind eye to business. It seemed seedy the way he had taken her to one side, and intimate as he supplied the magic potion. He was quite a bit of an older guy, bit of a sleaze, and there were stories of him serving it off the end of his penis. Gross. When I got what I needed from the stores, I heard the key in the lock behind me. I would have to knock next time. The head chef sweated in the nucleus of the kitchen. Pans sizzled and fat burst into flames. Tonight he was volatile, off his head on speed. He cooked aggressively, fucked up the occasional order, and when the waitress brought the order back with a complaint from the customer, he berated her competence in writing down the order. And as she walked further from earshot, he cursed her even more. He never swore at me, though, probably because dish pigs were neither here nor there. Being the grey man gave me a certain anonymity. I could hide in my little corner, alone in my thoughts, miles away from greasy pans and the sometimes vicious politics. The job held no worth, but that was mutual to both parties. Dish pigs had to be treated well, or they would simply leave.
"Rich, quick man, run upstairs and grab some strawberries and fettuccine,"
the head chef shouted. I ran out into the yard. Once out of sight, I ambled lazily up the stairs to the coal store. I could still make out the shadows of the manager fumbling around his desk through the blinds. The coal store was outside. I wouldn't have to disturb him. I slid open the door of Aladdin's cave and closed it behind me. I rubbed my hands together, wondering what I could eat first. Ooh, passion fruit pulp. There was this massive container. I took a big slug. Ate a few strawberries, some fresh dates, and then I chipped off a chunk from this massive block of white chocolate. The night progressed, faces got fed, and I threw a sinful amount of good food in the bin. I slid around in my corner of the kitchen, mechanically rotating around to load the dishwasher, blast pans, wipe surfaces. I was a monkey. The clean plates came out hot, food put back on and dashed out, and returned, and dessert and coffee. It was cyclic and menial. 7 hours of this. I think it was like 3 or 4 nights a week. $9 an hour, though, cash, so it wasn't too bad. At the back of the restaurant, a DJ worked his decks. It was dark and so dealable. It's a real drug den, this place, if you hadn't already guessed. The music was reaching. It teased a climax, eased off and started to build again. I was working at double speed, inspired somehow, even in the guts of this bullshit job. I was running to stand still. If I could make a big enough dent in the piling plates and pans, I could sneak off to the bog for a sit-down. I could hear the cheers and shrieks coming from the tiny dance floor. Bastard sounded to be having a good time. Suddenly, a customer walked into my little corner and snatched the water gun from my hands. He spoke in a South American accent. "No, no, you like this, this." He spread the pans, spread the plates. He's telling me how to do it. Fair enough. I leant back against the worktop and let him expend his enthusiasm. I mean, well, he was the man, after all, the Don. Confidence was running down his eroding nostrils. When he finally pissed off, I took hold of the gun and blasted round the kitchen again. I would be out of here soon. I would be out on the road again in my own addiction. Let these guys paddle around in their shadow lives. Let these guys paddle around in their shallow lives, surreal and drug-fucked, counterfeit smiles, fueled by the devil's dandruff. There were some real poses there, all leather clad with ponytails and just poncing around. It was pretty nauseating, to be fair. The owners of the cafe arrived. I saw the old guy with the beard cast a look into my pit. His wife checked out the arse of one of the customers. Word would have gotten upstairs as soon as they came in. The manager had cleaned up his mess and replaced it with his bookkeeping files. The owners had only just taken on the place and had no idea what was going on. I sensed a lull in the avalanche of cutlery and threw down my apron. I was sober and out of time with the pissheads as I clumsily wove my way through the crowd. I skirted the dance floor and via two doors found a cubicle to flake out. I took down my shorts, but it was merely an excuse to lie down almost naked and cool off. The main door slammed open and closed. Punters talked over the dribbles into the urinal trough. Then quiet. I fancied I could go another 5 minutes. Fuck the plates. Fuck fettuccine. I leant back against the cistern, daring myself to fall asleep. I lazily read the graffiti, hoping for one witty comment to have been added.
Life is good. Good food, pumping iron and fucking.
Someone had written. I was thinking dickhead when the bathroom door flew open, followed by the cubicle door next to mine. A guy tried to whisper. Okay, darling. He was unwrapping his coke. I'd heard it dozens of times. A cistern snort, a rail on top of the crapper. Right, lift up your dress. I heard a groan. I'd never heard of putting coke on genitalia before this moment. It's bonkers. you can research that. I'm not going into it. An ambulance came to pick up the new owner's wife. She'd been acting very strange. They took her to the mental health ward and kept her under observation. Nah, they probably wouldn't have taken her to the mental health ward. That's dumb. An ambulance came to pick up the owner's wife. She had been acting rather strange. They took her to hospital and kept her under observation. The story that unfolded was that she had sniffed out the biscuits that the chef had baked and insisted on trying one. Unwittingly, she had helped herself to a mull and acid-based cookie. Yeah, it was crazy. All these chefs and most of them were taking some sort of amphetamine drug of some description. I guess it was that sort of late night and your meridians are out of whack, but it was also associated with that kind of lifestyle. Bit of a party lifestyle, I guess. Later on, I rode along Bourke Street because I'd have to ride up from Bondi up this massive hill and then across town. I rode along Bourke Street. The rain was coming down and I followed the shiny orange footpath back home. I was getting wet, but it was refreshing and welcome after the sweatbox of a kitchen. A creepy guy loitered in a doorway and stared at me as I passed. I kept looking back. The axe murderer came to mind, but he didn't follow. I did the red flashing staircase and I was about to lie down when I heard someone moving in my room. I turned the light on to see Iris Carroll squinting at me. She was drunk.
Hey, Rich. I thought I'd sleep up here. I hope you don't mind. My room's saturated.
It was true. I'd sat on the toilet earlier, staring up at rain clouds closing in. Rob's joiners had stripped off the bathroom roof. The bathroom was directly above Carol's room, and the rain had run through everything. Good work, lads. Good work. Yeah. 5:28 was seriously knackered. Dilapidated. It was a joke to think I could solve all Rob's problems with a lick of paint and some polyfiller. Place needed shutting down, stripping out and starting again, but I kept on. It was my job I had to preserve. I ripped up all the carpets, denailed the floors and fixed all the loose floorboards ready for sanding. I picked at small cracks in the walls. The hollow plaster came off easily. After the plaster, the brickwork collapsed, leaving huge window-sized holes. After a month, the place was almost empty. People wanted out. Not even these guys could live in the middle of a bomb site. As I said, the cement in the walls must have had like a low amount of cement in it, because it was really wobbly. That's the technical term. The cement was wobbly. Yeah, look, it wasn't hard enough. Didn't have enough in it. And it's soft. And yeah, I was knocking the house down, effectively. Like I said, Robert had run-down houses all over Sydney. He'd be worth a mint now if he's still alive. I was to drive out to Marrickville to evict an old lady who hadn't paid her rent. Once she was out, I was to clean up the place, ready for Billy to move in. Remember Billy? Porno man. And the snags. He was going to move into this little place. The room was no more than a shed amongst the taro in the backyard of a Fijian household. It was cramped and dismal. I knocked on the door and frail old Rosie answered.
Oh, do you work for Robert? Come in, come in.
There was nowhere to sit, just the bed or the toilet. She offered to make me a cup of tea, but she'd run out of milk and tea bags and sugar. She treated me as a guest, and yet I was here to evict her. Neither of us mentioned that fact. I set about cleaning. Rosie dithered around in the bedroom, putting a few belongings into plastic bags. She had nowhere to go, but she went anyway. I put it to the back of my mind, the unfairness of turfing out an old woman into the street, and Robert with so much money, he wouldn't have missed the rent at all. Within a few hours, I'd vacuumed out the whole place, cleaned the windows, disinfected everything, and even splashed a bit of paint around. Irish Billy had his own expensive deadlock, so I removed the existing lock in readiness. As I was leaving, I passed Rosie. She was sat in an old armchair out the front. She smiled at me and slowly walked back into the house.
Bye, lad, she said. You've done a great job.
Billy never did take the place. It was even beneath his standards, and with no lock on the door, I reckon old Rosie might still be living there. This was in the late 90s. I mean, if she's still living there now, it would be a miracle. She'd be about 110. No, she'd probably be like 100. I got bored and lonely working on my own, so I made up two more work positions for a couple of Jay's mates, Dino and Justin. Emma, a Byron Bay friend, arrived. Jay moved in. Emma's friend turned up with a 10-foot mall under her arm, and then John, a friend of Justin's, flew in from London. On occasion, complete strangers would show up at the door saying that Jay had told them we could put them up for free. Fucking Jay. Robert had his suspicions, but didn't really care. It was his sister Jeanette who wouldn't leave us alone. She came round pretty regular to check up on us. This regular visit prompted me to rip down the rickety stair that led up to the attic. From then on, we got into the loft via a ladder. So yeah, that was like our safe zone where we could hide all the travellers. Jeanette was a nosy old cow, but even her curiosity wouldn't bring her to climb a ladder. The unofficial lodgers would have to sit up there until she left. Jay, as casual as ever, would always leave it to the last minute before he took up the stairs, wrapped in his sarong and leaving suspicious-looking footprints after his shower. Emma was a nurse and worked night shifts. She came and went and we hardly saw her. She'd sleep in the attic right through all our banging and sanding. After 10 a.m, the sun turned the attic into a furnace. If I had to go upstairs for any reason, I would find Emma asleep on the floor in her knickers, red-faced and perspiring. I found an old electric fan on the street, plugged it in, it worked, and made her days in the furnace bearable. Rob was more than pleased with our efforts. As far as he could see, through the mess and destruction, the house was moving along. The joiners came back and patched up the roof, fixed the balcony and stud partitions, A bricky gobbed up the big holes we'd made in the crumbling walls, and cement render hid all the evidence. On wages day, Rob appeared. His serious, solemn mush was squashed up inside a motorcycle helmet. His shiny black BMW was outside, the Friday toy for whipping around the city to take rent from the poor and give wages to the desperate. You might have noticed an old Volvo out the front. He threw the keys toward us. Look after it. We named it Big Banana. It was yellow. Dino was cool because he was just a chilled out guy. Like when he was just doing his couple of rollies, and he had his photography, his guitar, and he'd ride his bike. And he always played really cool tunes. He played like Primal Scream and the Stone Roses, but like the trippier songs that went on and had real build-ups. This is compared to Justin playing like the Black Grape and stuff in his old combi. Just had this old combi and it was so knackered. He had to hold it in fourth gear, using a Oki strap because it kept falling out. And the handbrake didn't work properly. And it was really old. And one time we went to a party in Bondi and I drove it back for him the next day and someone had left a piece of wood on the roof, aka Gidgey, and it was stuck out 2 meters either side and I drove this old knackered, like definitely not roadworthy combi from Bondi all the way back into the city and parked up with this lump of wood sticking out like aeroplane wings. I don't know, I didn't actually hit anybody. It was insane. And just when he actually left, when he left Sydney, he just left this combi in the street with his stuff, and apparently there was a tramp living in there, and then all the stuff got robbed over time, and then eventually it got towed away. It'd probably last about 20 seconds now in Sydney, with the parking being so expensive and everything. Robert pissed off on his motorcycle, and we weren't far behind. We clocked off early and drove out to Maroubra Beach. Dino rolled a spliff out the wind and lay back in the sand to watch Justin and me risk spinal injuries in the surf. Dino was a very relaxed person. He would gladly sit on a milk crate in a quiet corner, sanding and painting skirting boards, listening to the Stone Roses on his Walkman. Justin, on the other hand, was action man. He raced downhill mountain bikes and was training to be a skydiver. Justin was happy to do any loud, thrashing, bashing type jobs, and any element of risk was a godsend. If a scaffold needed erecting or a sledgehammer swinging, Justin was the man. Yeah, he was out there. He used to take his abseiling off the cliffs around Sydney, and he's always going skydiving and had loads of injuries from sending it big time downhill on his mountain bike. And now, all these years later, he's actually opened a little mountain bike business in WA, Western Australia, called Salties. Little plug there for you, Justin. Yeah, he was so full on. Like, we were camping one day with woke up about 8 o'clock and went outside. There's Justin coming back from just doing a skydive. We're all asleep and he's been 14,000 feet above us, flying through the air. But there was one thing about Justin that he had a little quirk, which was one night I found Justin on the landing talking to himself. Yeah, so I told her now for 3 quid, now I go. Now she said no. Well, it's 4:42, eh? Ah, hey, yeah! He was sleepwalking, sleep talking, and with a bit of sleep karate thrown in. Dodging his punches and kicks, I turned him around from the edge of the flight of stairs and directed him back to his room. Justin's sleepwalking and talking was legendary. And anyone who had spent a night next to him would find themselves a fly on the wall to one of his episodes. One day, Jeanette rushed into the house and wanted to know who was who, why, where, and when, and what were we actually doing? She saw Justin on the landing and cornered him. So who are you? I'm Justin. I work for Robert.
Oh, well, what do you do exactly?
Well, my trade, I'm a glazer.
A glazer? Well, good. I've got a new shower door I need fixing. I'll send for you.
Justin wasn't a glazer. He was a bike mechanic. I became the unofficial foreman and the go-between between the boss and the boys. I devised timesheets which recorded exactly what work we had done each day. This made Robert and Jeanette feel in control, when in fact the timesheets gave us creative license to exaggerate our working days. Something was working in 528. Each day our living standards seemed to improve. We had started with barely anything and made something from it. We could have been living like pigs, but we rose above it. We cruised around in the big banana. We had freedom, a place to stay, a balcony to watch the world go by, and stir fries for lunch. But one day, there was a knock at the door.
Is Dino in?
I'd leant over the balcony. I didn't recognise a figure standing there. The guy was scrawny with short cropped hair. I thought it might have been the addict who had pulled a knife on Justin the week before. He was stealing Justin's washing out the back. Bastard.
I'm Dino's, mate.
I dropped him the keys. They bounced out of his hands and he chased them down the steps. And then he was up the stairs and sat round the table, pulling out a bong from his coat. The journey ended that day for Dino. A rope had caught on some dead wood, and he jumped down to try and untie it, but then he got caught up himself. Nottingham Rob was one of Dino's best mates. The sort of mate you can love and hate with the same heart. The sort of mate who brings you as much joy as pain. In Nottingham, Dino and Rob had smoked so much dope that necessity replaced novelty. Tolerances set like concrete. And heroin was cheap. 10 quid and you could be fucked all weekend. They start to smoke the brown. No one intentionally sets out with the idea of sticking a needle in your arm. Things can happen so gradually they sneak up on you. Until it's normalised. My dad told me a story once that a guy stole a train carriage by moving it an inch every day. No one realised until it was round the corner, along a siding, and halfway to the guy's house. That was a classic, actually. He took it round to this siding in England, and then he dismantled it bit by bit, and he rebuilt the carriage in his backyard. And the only reason they found out was he was really sick, and they come round to see him, and they saw this carriage in his backyard. Stolen an entire train carriage. I think that's the best analogy of things slipping away from you. I just love the idea, like, move it an inch. Was that train an inch that? Nah, it was there. It's always been there. Was that train an inch that? Nah, it's always there. It's always been round the corner. Yeah, nah, there's never been a train there. Nottingham Rob still craved skag, brown, H. It had opened new doors for him. He lost his fat gut, met girls, and had fucking incredible conscious moments of life. I'd never known someone so close to hard drugs before. Most of my friends from Bradford just went for the slow death option of liver cirrhosis. I liked Dino. He was better in his new life, smoking just a couple of spliffs a day. I didn't like Rob. He was a sly fucker. He was going down, and he'd come back to take Dino with him. Dino came to the beach with us after work for the last time. Rob sat in the back of the Big Banana and smoked 18 bongs in succession before finally collapsing. Dino and Nottingham Rob got tight again, and we lost our mate. They took us up to Nimbin, a notorious drug-dealing village, 900 k's north, and came back with a bale of gear. They were going to become drug barons and travel on the profits. But most of the profits were packed tight in their cones and smoked. Dino seemed to be forever wearing his sunglasses. Blood vessels ran like tree roots across the whites of his eyes. After work, Justin and myself still tried to escape to the beach or the cliffs rock climbing. Dino would wait for Nottingham Rob and they'd get smashed. When we arrived home, Dino would be face down on his mattress or on the balcony in amongst takeaway boxes and mess. The next day, Dino was always numb from the gear. So numb that on his way to the hardware store, he crashed the Big Banana. Robert's trust in us began to wane and the Big Banana was gone. Come back, Big Banana. Yeah, that was a bummer. Lost our wheels. Work was for another day and Dino and I stood outside 528 Burke Street about to go our separate ways. He was off to meet Nottingham Rob again and I was off on my bike to the supermarket. Suddenly a man screamed across the road at us. Yoo-hoo! Hello, boys! He came dancing across the road towards us, waving his arms in the air, exposing his midriff. Come on, give us a kiss! Fuck off! Seemed to escape my lips uncontrollably, and I was a good 50 yards down the street before I stopped pedaling and thought about Dino. Shit, what if the mad axe murderer was gay? We were living on the edge of the second largest gay community in the world. It wasn't uncommon to pass blokes wearing ball gowns, big wigs and high heels, bitching amongst themselves. It's part of life here, in a place where if you were gay, you weren't such a minority. A place where nobody knew you and you could come out without getting the shit kicked out of you by a gang of homophobes. With the exception of being accosted in the street for a kiss, I was indifferent to this scene. However, there was one thing that spun me out. A thought sparked by two couples hand in hand walking toward each other in the street. One couple was made up of a petite, beautiful girl and a solidly built masculine female partner. They were about to cross the paths with a lean, very feminine male guy holding hands with a Burt Reynolds lookalike in tight leather pants. And I was like a fly on the wall to this situation. So I don't want to offend anybody here, but what I'm saying is that, so there's a masculine lesbian with a feminine lesbian walking down a street meeting a masculine gay guy with a feminine gay guy. Nobody seemed to know which voice to adopt. Not that there were any rules, but, well, as a fly on the wall, I pondered. If the dominant male liked his partner for his feminine ways, why wasn't he attracted to women? And if the petite girl preferred the masculine female, why didn't she like men? Maybe they did, but this was a total confusion of sexuality to me. It's not black and white, Richard. As I said, I'm sorry if I sound like a buffoon. I went back to help Dina. The gay man wasn't the mad axeman, but the mad knife man was the gay man. This is talking about Timo. Going back to Timo. It kind of flowed when I wrote this story. The next time I saw Timo, the guy who had gone berserk with a carving knife at Bri's place, his voice had changed. He had short-cropped peroxide blonde hair, makeup on, and fluffy blue earrings. This is living in the gay second largest gay capital. I'd actually been back and forth a few times working for Robert. This is like the best time. It's not actually chronologically in order. When I was living with Justin, Jay and Dino. But there was a couple of other times I worked for Robert beforehand. And one time I lived with these two dudes in Newtown. And I didn't twig at all. Like, same deal, we were washing out the back, like, getting naked, queuing up for the shower out the back. And one of the guys, Dave, kept getting loads. He'd always bring a girl on every Friday night. And we were giving him stick about being a bit of a hussy. And then one day, a bloke came out of his bedroom, and I said, "Who's that?" And his mate Chris goes, "Oh, that's Dave's girlfriend." I'm like, "Ah, all right." And then it all sort of came together. Like, we'd been to the Mardi Gras. We used to go and see quite a few drag shows, which wasn't new to me after the Madalos back in Bradford. So that was no big deal, but we'd be all these drag shows a lot. And they were really theatrical, these two guys. They were more like sisters than mates. They were really good buddies. And we went to the Mardi Gras, and at the end they were so excited they jumped the fence. And we ended up, I just got caught up in the moment because it was so great, the procession and everything. You got like dykes on bikes and people sprayed all different colours and just the whole showmanship. And they jumped the fence, like, yeah! So I just jumped the fence with them and we're running behind the Mardi Gras procession. I just did not twig that at least one of these guys was gay. And then when I actually finally left to go to another country, Dave wrote a little poem in my journal. And it was, "Rich is nice, rich is good. I would do him if I could." So they were good guys. They were really they had songs, like they could sing songs, rendition them start to finish, like perfectly, and they'd do it in these big theatrical voices, so they were real showmen. But in living in Surrey Hills, on one time, because I'd saw a few Mardi Gras, one time I actually climbed up a telegraph pole, got on this awning, walked across and climbed into this private party. Because everyone was climbing up to see the Mardi Gras, to get the view. I ended up on the roof and then I thought, I'll stuff it, I'll go in this party, but I got kicked out. It's like an exclusive, you can imagine it. Mardi Gras view vistas party in Oxford Street. But yeah, I was walking through town one day on this Mardi Gras, went down this dark alley, and this like 6'5" blonde, long blonde hair bloke with a hairy chest, big boobs, and massive stilettos with his sequin blue dress on. He's like, "You all right, mate?" I'm like, "Yeah, buddy, how you going?" Looking up at this like Amazonian guy. One day we're actually at Maroubra, and you guys might have heard of the Bra Boys. They're like this tough gang that used to run the surf there, amongst some other stuff. And I think there's even a movie about it where Russell Crowe, he's the narrator, about the Bra Boys. The Bra Boys get up, go and cause some havoc. How about surfing a break? They surf this really heavy break. They start surfing a heavy break out there called Hours and Cape Solander. It's an absolute wedge. If you check it out, it's like a suicide break. Breaks right onto the rocks, like literally guys get spat up the rocks regular. But there's Jay out on his surfboard, because Jay came and went a few times. He went when he went to Indo. After the working in the mental hospital, he's always had these business brainwaves, and he came back. He's like, "I've got a load of sarongs. I'm going to sell them. I'm going to make lots of money." loads of people in the house we're living in at Burke Street walking around with these sarongs. All the same, like they weren't. There wasn't that much variation, same pattern, like 4 or 5 different colours. But yeah, Jay, he's out surfing at Maroubra, and he dropped in. I think he must have dropped in on this bra boy. And when you're learning to surf, you're a kook. Like, no matter, you know, compared to these guys who were born in the water. And he's just surfed up behind Jay and just kicked his board straight at Jay. And the nose went through his wetsuit and nearly broke a rib. Yeah, poor Jay. He's on the beach, holding his suit and in pain. Actually, and I'm not allowed to say the joke that, oh, we're the bra boys. I'm just kidding, but it does sound funny, you gotta say. But it's Maru bra. It's not that they're actually wearing bras. As I said, this story is a mishmash at times. So this is like the third time I was actually working for Robert. I come home from work one day and Jay's at the door like I'm in trouble.
Your dad's here.
What? I went upstairs and there's Dad asleep on the sofa, on the veranda. He'd come out to hang out with us. We were going to travel for a long time, but in the end, I think I mentioned it before, he couldn't live in my poverty line. And I think he was in his 50s then, like, I imagine, yeah, you put up with more shit when you're younger, I think. Dad crashed at 528 Burke Street with the rest of us. I cleaned out Jim's room and he decked down. Everyone in the house and all my friends liked my dad, especially Dino. Dad fixed his bong for him. Good on you, Dad. You should have put a secondary exhaust on it so it filtered away most of the gear so he wasn't getting so smashed. And that's really funny because my dad's not like that at all. He's just a very resourceful inventor type. Drugs are not on his radar at all. After finishing the community service, Jay left and went surfing in Bali, aka, and then he come back with his blah blah blah. Come back with his sarongs. The whole house and anybody who knew him was walking around in one or owned one. He ran out of people to sell them to, and as always, he was skint. Robert was getting over the big banana mishap with Dino, and I persuaded him to give Jay 2 weeks' work. As Jay was tall, I set him up on the stairs, rolling paint onto the walls. But he was still in travelling mode and reluctant to speed up. Bare feet, wearing nothing but his board shorts, he worked the roller in big, slow arcs, so he didn't have to move too much. Yeah, he literally wasn't moving and just rolling, like, in a fan shape. Travelling had spoiled him, and he couldn't really take working for me seriously. Can we stop for a tea now, Rich? Come off it, Jay. You've only been working for half an hour. I'll make us some toast. Shit. All right. But if Jeanette or Robert shows up, try and look busy. This was Jay, though, and me too, if I could ever escape this city life. But Robert was my means to escape. I couldn't take the piss completely. When it came time for Jay to leave, I lent him a few bucks and he marched out into the day. He was hitching down to Shepparton, a fruit-growing area near Melbourne, to pick pears. Jay's worldly possessions consisted of a didgeridoo, a pair of raggedy-ass jeans, his board shorts and a few T-shirts, and, of course, a load of sarongs. On his first ride out of Sydney, the guy dropped him at a servo and told Jay that he would wait for him while he tried to get a ride in a truck. Jay's pack was still in the boot. He knew it was a risk to leave it with a driver, but there were security cameras here. When he stepped round the corner, the driver took off with his backpack. Jay, someone had made him a didgeridoo by hand, and that's what got stolen, and that's the most upsetting part. This was seriously bad karma, but then Jay had clocked up a few bad points himself lately. But he did do community service, so that should have counter-karmaed that issue. I was walking down to Central Station with my dad when Jay appeared with nothing but the clothes on his back. We packed him up again with a few hand-me-down clothes and a tent. Everybody chipped in some bit. Dina, just. And we sent him back out to pick his pears. On this time, actually, this chapter, like the next chapter is going to New Zealand, but in reality, when I was working at this time for Robert, I was actually heading back through Asia, and I saved $5,000 in 6 months, and I lasted in Asia for 7 months on that money. So I think when you've got to sweat so much to earn it, you think a bit more before you spend it as well. But on the last night there, it was crazy because remember first day walking into that lonely place and the methadone guy and being scared and all the shadows and the flashing lights. And we're having this big party up in one of the main rooms with which had the veranda, which is obviously the favourite. And there were so many friends there now. There was like 30 friends, 20 or 30 friends. Big party. My dad's there. Dad's bought a slab of VB. He's got it on his shoulder. I think he loved that. And everyone was chatting to him and wanting to know him. It was great. So yeah, it turned it all around in 6 months from having nothing. And when I actually did arrive there, this is after New Zealand, I came back to this, I had $20 in my pocket. $20 in my ass pocket. And I'd actually borrowed a bit of money too. So I was actually in debt. I borrowed some money from a lady in Tonga, a Danish lady. So yeah, I had nothing. And then suddenly I had everything. Just goes to show. And then you're walking down the streets of Sydney and there's guys with little cardboard bits of paper saying, please help me. I don't want to do anything. So can you give me your money? Be fighting the urge to say, mate, get off your fucking ass and go and do something, man. Thanks for listening. And yeah, next time I'm getting back on a bike. Managed to get a bike at the Flying Hedgehog. I'm staying at the Flying Hedgehog in Hamilton in New Zealand. We're 4 hours flight from Sydney. And get a pushy. And I just set off again. It's like $150, this pushy. It's a lot less of a fancy, like, fart around like when I first set off. It was just like, the simple plan was, get bike, tie backpack on back the best you can, and bugger off. So that's the only steps you need to know if you ever want to travel around the world on a bicycle. See you next time. Thanks for listening, and hope everybody's doing well.